From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. St. Thomas, one of the U.S. Virgin Islands, is among a group of islands devastated by Hurricane Irma. Water and food remain scarce there as rescue crews, some of whom are just residents with chainsaws, continue to clear debris and downed power lines from damaged roads. Jeff Neville is pastor at the St. Thomas Reformed Church, and he joins us now. Pastor, tell us, how are you doing and what's it like there today?
We're doing well. Complete devastation on the island. It's hard to even describe and fathom. I've never seen anything like it. I was here shortly after Maryland and saw a little bit of it, but just on a much bigger level. It's vast. I know many have seen pictures and videos through the media and social media, and it's worse than what you're seeing. But there are bright spots everywhere. I mean, we're seeing people rallying, pulling together, communities, churches, nonprofits, reaching out and helping neighbors and beginning the process of rebuilding. So many people lost their homes and their property and are hungry, thirsty, tired, you know, without power, hard to get around, hard to communicate.
Do you mind if I ask? I mean, the images that people have been seeing are truly terrible. But if it's even worse than that, I mean, what exactly do you mean?
Well, you know, I mean, when you're on the ground and there's a human element to it, and it's not just people, it's pets and other, you know, living creatures, and people have lost their entire homes, and they're living hunkered down in single rooms and trying to collect what's left of their belongings. Yeah. We're doing triage at this point. Safety and security is a concern. There's been some looting, and I think that would lessen, the more we can get people fed. That's the biggest thing, and that's what we're trying to do at the church and our Brothers Workshop Cafe, which is next door. The power came on at our church and cafe yesterday and fed almost 400 people, and we're going to do that every day as we are able.
Wow.
And we ran power cords to the street so people could charge their phones, and the supplies that are coming in, we're getting organized so that we can hand those out and get them to those most in need. And, that all takes coordination, and with curfew, we only have 6 hours in the day to work, really. Roads are still blocked, and crews need to get out there and, hang wires and clear roads and things. And it's hard to do when they're clogged with cars.
Has everyone been accounted for, or are there people missing?
I know there are people that I have not accounted for, everybody in my congregation. I mean, almost everybody, but there are a few people we just haven't heard from. And I can't speak for the rest of the island. I'm sure there are people that we haven't heard from.
Yeah. The weariness, if I'm hearing you correctly, the weariness in your voice is entirely understandable, because it sounds like there is a monumental effort that has to get underway to get the island fully up and running again. I mean, how long do you think it might take?
I have no idea. I was ready for 6 months without cell phone and without electricity, but we got it back in a week. I know there's a ton of work to be done, and I know, there's the worst maybe is yet to come and jobs and money and things become scarce and the economy tanks and all that. But after these things, people do pull together, and you get hyper-focused on what is truly important.
Have you had a chance to have any kind of service at the church?
Yes, we had service on Sunday. People gathered, and it was wonderful, but there were several people that I had not heard from that I was trying to contact. So we were all hugging and crying and sharing stories, and then we started making connections, and we're getting trucks that are lined up to go out and to board up homes. And, what we need are tarps. I mean, FEMA tarps are the things that cover the roofs where people are living, and we don't have a single FEMA tarp. We were told they were delivered to the island, like 6,000 of them. I have yet to see one on any of the roofs where I've driven, where I can look out right now all over town. I don't see a single blue tarp. I don't know where they are, but we sure would love some, because we have crews that'll go out, and anybody that needs one will help them put it up so that they can at least stay dry and start to put their lives back together.
So that makes us wonder, what else is FEMA doing? Do you see any other evidence of their assistance?
I mean, we've seen lots of helicopters and planes, and, there are Navy ships here and people on the ground, boots on the ground, and we're getting better organized where the supplies that are coming in, I know from Puerto Rico, from St. Croix, are making it to us. And again, that's just a matter of logistics and trying to work around curfews and work, you know, with very little fuel. We're trying to conserve fuel because we can't just run to the airport or run to the marina every time a shipment comes in and unload it. We don't have the manpower or the fuel to do that right now anyways, but that's our goal. But those systems are getting in place. Private citizens are pulling together. We have a warehouse now and some trucks where we're getting stuff. And then every day, every morning, we're going to try to load up our trucks and bring it down to the church and the cafe and distribute it.
Yeah. Well, Pastor Jeff Neville with the St. Thomas Reformed Church. Pastor Jeff, thank you so very much. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Magna. Thank you for your support and everybody. And keep the prayers and support coming. We appreciate it very much.
Well, we learned yesterday that Edith Windsor has died. She was the plaintiff in the landmark Supreme Court case, United States versus Windsor, that laid the groundwork for the legalization of same-sex marriage. Windsor was 88. She was 81 years old in 2010 when she sued the federal government over the Defense of Marriage Act. In 2013, the Supreme Court ruled that same-sex couples in some states were entitled to federal benefits. Other rulings followed, and in June of 2015, the Supreme Court legalized marriage for same-sex couples. In 2013, NPR's Nina Totenberg profiled Edith Windsor before the court's decision.
The crux of her legal case is that after more than four decades living with Thea Speier and a marriage recognized as legal in New York, Edie Windsor had to pay $363,000 in estate taxes when Speier died because the federal government did not recognize their marriage as valid.
If Thea was Theo, I would not have had to pay that. It's heartbreaking. It's just a terrible injustice, and I don't expect that from my country. I think it's a mistake that has to get corrected.
Windsor was born in 1929, shortly before her parents lost their home and business in the Depression. As a teenager, she was, by her own account, very popular with boys. And after graduating from Temple University, Windsor got married. But at the movies, she secretly identified with leading man Dick Powell, not his frequent co-star, Ruby Keeler. So, after less than a year, Edie and her husband divorced.
I told him the truth. I said, honey, you deserve a lot more. You deserve somebody who thinks you're the best because you are. Okay, and I need something else.
She moved to New York City, worked as a secretary, got a master's in mathematics at NYU, and soon was on her way to a career as a top programmer at IBM. All the while, she hid her homosexuality.
Societally, that was, you know, that was impossible. I really was a middle-class girl. And of course you didn't want to be queer.
Finally, though, she asked an old friend for help.
If you know where the lesbians are, please take me. And so she took me to the Portofino restaurant.
There she met Thea Speier, who for 42 years would be the love of her life and eventually her wife. Speier was a psychologist with a large New York practice. In 1967, on a drive to the country, Thea asked Edie what she would do if she got an engagement ring. After all, if coworkers saw it, they'd want to meet the guy.
And when we got to the house, she got out of the car and got down on her knees and said, Edie Windsor, will you marry me? And this pin appeared.
A circle pin with diamonds. At the time, of course, there was no place the two could actually marry, but they led good lives together. After 13 years, Thea was diagnosed with MS, but the disease at first progressed slowly.
Her first symptom was she couldn't complete her golf swing, and then it was very gradual, except it turned into a fairly vicious progressive MS.
Edie eventually took early retirement to help care for Thea, and they waited and hoped for the day New York would legalize same-sex marriage. Thea continued to see patients, but in the last years of her life, much of Edie's time was devoted to helping her partner. The two thought of going to Canada, where same-sex marriage was legal and recognized by New York State, but Edie says that with all the lifts and gear that Thea needed to travel,
my feeling was I don't have to drag her through that.
Then suddenly, it was clear the end was near.
She got a lousy prognosis, which said within a year. And she got up the next morning and she said, do you still want to get married? And I said, yes. And she said, me too. And we did.
They flew to Toronto with two best men and four best women. The photos show nothing but joy.
The fact is, you know, marriage is this magic thing. I mean, forget all the financial stuff. Marriage symbolizes commitment and love like nothing else in the world, and it's known all over the world. I mean, wherever you go, if you're married, that means something to people. And it meant the difference in feeling the next day was profound. And I've asked everybody since who gets married after long-term relationships, did it feel different the next day? And the answer is always yes, absolutely.
Fia Speyer died 21 months after the couple's wedding. Edie has a life-size photo of Thea in their apartment. She says she sometimes leans up against it and talks to Thea about the progress of the case known as Windsor versus the United States. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
A case that'll now be in the history books. That story from Nina Totenberg's 2013 interview with Edith Windsor, who died yesterday at the age of 88. You're listening to Here and Now.
President Donald Trump is planning to have dinner tonight with two Democrats, New York Senator Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. They're the Democrats with whom Trump struck a spending deal last week, which is still sending some shockwaves through Republican circles. And this morning, the president tweeted, "With Irma and Harvey devastation, tax cuts and tax reform is needed more than ever before. Go, Congress, go." Is he ready to make another deal?
Also in Washington today, former Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders introduces his bill to provide Medicare for all. And this time, Democrats are flocking on board. So lots to talk about with our Here and Now political analyst, Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. And Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Hi, Paris.
Hello, hello, hello.
And let's start with the storms, which we've been talking about for weeks now. People think back to Hurricane Katrina, and a lot of people remember George W. Bush saying to his FEMA director, Michael Brown, "Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job," as Katrina devastated New Orleans in 2005. What is there to say about President Trump's response so far to Irma and Harvey? Jamal, is it kudos to the president?
I think in a moment like this where Americans are under real stress and duress across big swaths of the country, I've got friends and family right now who are out of their homes in Florida and other people's homes in Georgia right now trying to just hunker down and wait for everything to ease up. I think we've got to give the president and his administration enough credit to have behaved as normally as possible during this great time of strife. And so let's just, let them have this day because it's not really about them. It's about the people who have been affected and making sure they get what they need.
And Paris, let me just turn to you because I actually would say that I think the FEMA director has done an extraordinary job. And the question is, can that continue in the months and years to come? Because it's going to take a long time to get Texas and Florida fully back on their feet.
Well, Jamal's wrong. It is about the president. It is about the federal government, because if they did a horrible job, we would be blaming them and saying that they were inept and they couldn't do what they were supposed to do. Leon Panetta was on television yesterday praising the fact that the administration has done a good job as it relates to this responding to these hurricanes. The president went down, the first lady, the second lady, the vice president, they went down to Texas twice, and they're going to Florida tomorrow. The FEMA director is doing an excellent job. The governors have praised him consistently, both in Texas and Florida, saying that they have had seamless conversations and getting everything that they need, including the mayor of Houston. And so we should give credit when credit's due. The president rose to the occasion. The federal government is doing what it's supposed to do, and it's responding in not just a normal fashion, but responding in an extraordinary fashion for an extraordinary hurricane. They did an excellent job, and they will continue to do so because it's a priority. That's why the deal was struck with the Democrats, because the president understands that this is about the American people and those that are suffering. So he'll cut a deal with Democrats to get the best deal for the American people and those that are suffering because of these hurricanes.
It's only remarkable because the president has set such a low standard and a low bar on every other aspect of the presidency that when he behaves normally, we expect to give him such
Jamal,
great credit.
But to be fair, if it were a Democratic president, don't you think Democrats would be rallying around the president saying, look what extraordinary leadership we're seeing now in the wake of these disasters? I mean, I think Paris has a point.
I don't begrudge the Republicans from being happy that the president could behave normally, but if he had behaved poorly, like George Bush did during Katrina, then they would deserve blame. This is one of those places where, yes, when you do things badly, you get blame. When you do things well, people say, nice job, but they keep moving on. It's just the way it works.
Just a quick quote. Donna Brazile came back and said the president, George W. Bush, did an excellent job in relates to Katrina. And with the truth
After the storm was over, after the floods were over.
Actually, Donna Brazile was back channeling to the White House the entire time throughout Katrina because she knew that it was something that was important. And the truth be told, it wasn't the lack of the federal government response. It was a lack of response from the lack of direction from the mayor and the governor not wanting to get the federal government involved. That's why they suffered so much. But
well, we had an election about that in 2008 and in 2006 and in 2008, and George Bush lost. This is about the future and about right now.
Yeah.
And I think we do have to give, as I said when I started, the president behaved normally. People were taken care of. It's about making sure those people are taken care of so they get credit for that.
Okay. Let me move on to another issue because there's a lot to talk about here. And the president is having dinner tonight with Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader in the House, and Chuck Schumer, the leader in the Senate. Tax changes to the tax code. He's saying that maybe he can make a deal. Paris, is it likely that that deal is going to involve the Democrats like the last one did?
Listen, to be on the side of tax reform is to be on the side of the American taxpayer, small business owners, minorities, the American people who are suffering. Tax reform is something that is positive. This do-nothing idea that there's a do-nothing Congress needs to be a do-something Congress. The president is doing a lot. The Congress needs to do something. They need to do it before Thanksgiving. Get it done. This is not about politics. This is about putting money back into the hands and the wallets of the American people.
But do you think he's going to do it with the Democrats, is my question.
I think he needs to do it with the Democrats, and I think the Democrats would be foolish not to do it because tax reform is a winning solution, and they need all the help they can get.
I offered some pushback to Jamal a couple of minutes ago. Paris, it's my turn to offer you a little bit of pushback. A giant tax cut for the richest Americans is not the reform of the United States tax code. Come on.
That's true, but I would push back to you and ask you, what bill are you looking at? There's been no specific plan put
in
place.
Well, but exactly, there's no plan.
Right? So this is why it's important for him to meet with Democrats and Republicans to come together and to put together a plan that is not just a talking point from the left saying that it's about tax cuts for the rich. This is going to be something that's going to be specific and helpful to middle class and small business owners and those that are lower trying to come up.
Well,
tax reform is something that is positive. So the notion that it's just for the rich when there is no plan is false.
Let's talk about the ideas that have been on the table that I think would be deal killers for the Democrats. I think that the president should try to do a deal with the Democrats. That probably means getting people involved who are from the relevant committees, but that's not the strategy he's going after. He's trying to pick Democrats off, which is fine. It's his right to do as the president. But what will kill it for Democrats is if he tries to pass an estate tax lift where we cut the estate tax for the wealthiest families. What will kill it if he tries to eliminate the homeowner exemption where people who are buying homes no longer get to take a tax exemption for the interest that they pay on those mortgages. Or what would kill it. The last thing is that they try to eliminate the deduction for state and local taxes, which goes to a lot of people who pay taxes to the state and local government. Why should you have to pay taxes both on your federal income and then on the money that you pay to state and local government? You should not pay taxes on money that's being taken from you in taxes.
What about the issue of health care, which is also coming back up this week? Bernie Sanders, the former Democratic presidential candidate, has introduced a bill that is calling for a single-payer system. And it sounds like people like Joe Manchin, who's one of the most conservative Democrats in the Senate, is saying we should have this conversation now. Jamal, is this realistic or is this just a proposal that will go nowhere?
I'm not sure if we're ready to pass a single-payer bill today. It's a big thing to do. But what I do know is that by arguing for single payer, we're going to move the debate back in the direction where it needs to go. There are a lot of people who believe that a single payer system is the most efficient way to provide health care to Americans. And so we've got to make sure that we give people that opportunity. And so I think for Democrats, saying things like this that are going to actually put identifiable chicken into the pots of working class people who feel like the wealthiest are getting the most out of the system and they're getting the least, we've got to find a way to make sure that working class people participate in the American system fairly.
Paris?
You know, single payer didn't work. It's not working in Canada or Europe. I think it's a litmus test for an already divided Democratic
Party. I don't understand how you say it's not working in Canada or Europe.
I think that when you look at the high taxes, the long wait times, and the fact that you can't the quality of care that you're getting is just not a good system for our country. We need something that's better. And a $32 trillion program, which is the reports I've heard, is not what you're going to do right now. And I don't think you're going to have a lot of Democrats coming on board to support this because you already had the failures of Obamacare. Now you're going to try to add this on.
Well, Obamacare is only having trouble because the president won't encourage people to continue to join it. And he's, and the destabilization about funding the insurance companies that are giving coverage to human beings who are in jeopardy is what's destabilizing the market. If the president would actually perform his duty and fund the bill the way it's supposed to and actually get people to join, the Obamacare would be fine.
But Jamal, just want to ask Jamal a quick question. There's a deeper issue here. I mean, there are some people on the left who are worried that Medicare for All may backfire because it actually possibly could reduce the coverage that a lot of people already have. That when you dig down into the details, you might get everyone insured, but a lot of people could actually have reduced coverage, and that's a problem, isn't it?
Well, there's a lot of space between where we are today and where we'll get if we have a single-payer system, and that's going to be what is required for the members of Congress and the leaders of the parties to figure out to get us in a place where it can work. The question, though, is do we believe that it is a right for everybody in the society to be covered by health care, and what's the most efficient way for us to do that? And I think that's the path that we ought to be on.
One more question, and we can give you each about 20 seconds for an answer. I'll start with you, Paris. Is Hillary Clinton's return to the spotlight good for the Democrats or the Republicans?
Well, it's definitely good for the Republicans because if you ask the question, what happened, we can tell you what happened. Donald Trump is now the president of the United States. He's going to make America great again. But I think it's bad for the Democrats because she's taken away time and resources from actually helping the Democrat Party. Instead of going on a self-serving, everybody else blaming book tour, she should be out there fundraising for Democrats and raising money for Bob Menendez, who needs a lot of money and support because he's going down in this trial. So it's like it's misfocused. It's always on her. It's always on Hillary Clinton, not on the American people. That's why she lost the election. Be focused on her party and on the American people and not blame everyone else for your loss.
Take your 20 seconds, Jamal. There you go.
Hillary Clinton is an American hero. She's a public servant beyond measure that everyone should have great regard for. I don't think she was a great candidate. I don't think she ran a great campaign, which is why I think she's not president today. But she is somebody that we should all have a lot of respect for, and I look forward to hearing and reading more about her perspective.
She's a better author than she is a candidate.
Okay.
Again, with the chief
Jamal Simmons and Paris Dinar, Democratic strategist, Republican strategist, here now, political analyst, both. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
JP Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon took another shot at Bitcoin this week, calling it a fraud and saying the market will eventually blow up. You wouldn't know it from the price of Bitcoin, which has been on a tear near $4,000 today. But late last week, state-owned media in China reported that Beijing plans to ban all cryptocurrency exchanges. For more, we're joined by Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal. Jason, why would the Chinese government want to ban Bitcoin and other cryptocurrency exchanges?
Hi there, Jeremy. Well, China's long been a major hub for Bitcoin, and this government's attack on it comes amid a focus on preventing capital from fleeing to digital currencies like Bitcoin. Beijing's obsessed with micromanaging its own hard currency, the yuan. And this is also part of a broader effort to root out risks to the country's financial system. And on top of that, you've got Beijing concerned about Chinese investors who are continuing to speculate and expose themselves to really big losses potentially.
But can China actually do this? Does the government in China have the power to ban Bitcoin?
To a degree and to a very large degree. China's central bank, together with other regulators, have put together instructions that ban Chinese platforms from providing Bitcoin to trading services. That said, analysts feel that, you know, more virtual currency activity in China is going to move off of these exchanges and individuals will just be trading with each other privately.
It doesn't sound like this news has had that big of an effect on the price of Bitcoin, which is still very high.
It's still very high, but though at one point this week it was down 10% on the Chinese news. And then you also said what Jamie Dimon said at a Barclays conference. He said that said it was worse than tulip bulbs. And he says that it won't end well. Someone is going to get killed.
Well, and I saw that he said that any trader that he finds out is trading Bitcoin would be fired. I don't know if he was joking about that or not. But there was another headline from China I want to ask you about. It had to do with cars. This week, the country has set a deadline for car makers to stop selling cars that run exclusively on gas or diesel fuel. What's driving that decision?
Well, they're casting it as an environmental decision. And we all know that Beijing in particular is plagued by air pollution.
Right.
But there's also some strategic goals as well. One, cutting expensive oil imports to the country. And they also want to be a real front runner in electrical vehicle manufacturing. They've been offering local manufacturers really generous government subsidies and putting in place policies that encourage foreign automakers to enter in joint ventures with Chinese companies and create new production facilities on Chinese soil. It really sees the electrical vehicle market as an enormous one, and it's going to spur it. And it's hoping to get 5 million electric cars on the roads by 2020. That's just 3 years from now.
Which I imagine would have a big impact on the global auto industry.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, last year, total vehicle sales in China reached 28 million. That's up 13% from the year before. So to tap into China in a big way, U.S. automakers are going to need more electrical and electrified vehicles up in their lineups.
That's Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal. Jason, thanks as always.
Thank you.
School is back in session, and some school districts are making some timing changes this year. Schools in Seattle, Boston, Corpus Christi, and Washington, D.C. have made the school day longer as a way to extend learning time and improve student performance. But is longer always better? Joining us now is Maria Ferguson, who's the executive director of the Center on Education Policy at the George Washington University. Maria, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And is there an ideal length of the school day at this point? Have we figured out?
Not really. What we know is that the school day length is contextual. So depending on the community, it's really best for them to decide what their students need in terms of average school day, school week, or school year. Because when you talk about expanding time, it could be any variation on that theme.
What do you mean by that?
Well, for some people, they choose to add hours to the school day. So they may add additional time in the morning or the afternoon. In some communities, they may add time to the school year. So you may actually have a year-round school calendar that breaks up the time students have off throughout the school year as opposed to having, say, that traditional summer block. There's been a lot of research on this topic about summer loss and school start times. So time as a resource and as a tool for learning has really become a hot topic, and it's in some ways a very controversial topic, especially in this country.
And it's not fair to say that the more time kids spend in school, the more learning they're going to be doing?
No, it's definitely not fair. I think the way we tend to think about it is more is not enough. It has to be better. So it has to be more and better learning time. So the time spent, I mean, if you're in a school where the teaching is not of a high quality or the conditions are not conducive to learning, simply providing more of that is not going to do anything for students. It's really making the time that they have far more positive, far more productive, and that it demonstrates yielding results for the students that matter.
So what would be a good example of a school that adds time? Let's say they add 40 minutes or an hour to the school day and then uses that time wisely.
So a good example would be a school that uses their time as something that supports both their students and their teachers. This is one of the things that we have found in our research, that teachers are sometimes the most grateful beneficiaries of not only extra time, but more flexible time. They appreciate having the time to engage in collaborative planning, to do professional development for themselves. It helps make them better teachers, helps make them more effective teachers. For students, say if you're in a school district that has students that are high impact, low income, struggling with some of the core instructional subjects, having a little bit more time to give them that extra help that they need in reading and math can really make a difference for those students. So it's very situational. School districts that have more resources audiences tend to think about how they use time very differently. It's often for enrichment activities, activities that sometimes cost the parents extra monies. So there's this overlay of income that really comes into the use of time in a school district that is both interesting and provocative.
And to that point, you hear stories sometimes about school districts that are really strapped for cash and they have to shorten the school day or even the school week. And it always sounds like it's a terrible thing when you hear about something like that happening. Is it always a bad thing for the school day to be shortened?
Yeah, it's pretty much always a bad thing. I mean, unless you're compensating in some other way. In low-income communities, the schools not only provide a source for educating students, but a lot of times it's the source for their meals. Kids can get one, two, and in some cases three meals a day at the school. It provides them with a safe haven, perhaps, if their neighborhood is a challenged neighborhood, a neighborhood that's prone to violence. Giving them a safe haven in a school can sometimes be, the only place that they can go to feel safe. And if they have, you know, working parents who are working full time, having those parents to then provide childcare for the time that their kids are out of school can be an enormous stress factor for them. We've seen this in this area, in the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area. Maryland just changed their school calendar. They used to start school before Labor Day weekend. Now they start after Labor Day weekend, which was done solely for economic reasons, to ensure that those beach resorts keep making money over the Labor Day weekend. And a lot of educators felt that that was an extremely negative thing to do for students because it goes against what all the research tells us. But there you have it. So less time is usually not better.
Well, school districts in Los Angeles and Denver and Rochester, New York have extended learning time. Do we know how it's been going in those cities?
Yeah, we do. I mean, our research has followed some of those cities quite carefully. And, you know, the potential outcomes are wonderful for students, obviously. Student engagement, better culture, the teachers are happier, there's more parent and community support. The challenge is it's sometimes hard to attribute those gains from just the increased time, because the time is connected to so many other factors. So, and this is a wonky research point, but from a research perspective, can you say it was the time alone that helped improve performance in those districts? Probably not, but it's what the time does to the other factors involved that really helps it along. That's not to say there aren't challenges, because certainly all of those districts face challenges, and some of them traditionally are funding challenges. Having more time on the calendar usually costs school districts more. Transportation, believe it or not, is one of the biggest challenges. It's often said that school districts live and die by bus schedules, and it's very true, and often buses have to be rerouted to accommodate, you know, if a school day goes longer or starts earlier. The parents sometimes can resist it. It's not something that they may want. And the students and the teachers themselves can just get tired, depending on how the time is used. It can be exhausting for them. So the leaders have to be really thoughtful about how they do this and really, you know, watch the effects of it and then make tweaks and corrections and mid-course changes if need be.
As you know, the school day is at this point just a part of a child's daily schedule. I wonder what a longer day means for after-school activities, for after-school sports, for after-school jobs in some cases.
Mm-hmm. It affects all of those things. And in some communities, the longer school day allows students who may not have been able to participate in sports or enrichment activities, it may give them the opportunity to do so. But in other instances, especially, I mean, you make a very good point, as it pertains to older students, it may hinder their ability to work after school. And for some families, having that child work after school is essential to their family's lifeblood. You know, it helps their family survive. Same with year-round schools. It may eliminate that summer job that so many high school juniors and seniors have, because when you go to school all year round, it's really hard to hold down a job for more than 2 weeks at a time. So it impacts all of those things, which is why we say that it is contextual, and districts really need to develop the strategies that work best for their community, for their students and their parents.
Extending the school day also, of course, takes away some of the unstructured time that kids have. Is that a problem, or maybe they don't need so much unstructured time?
Well, again, I think it depends on the community in which you live in. If you live in a safe community with a lot of resources and parks and people who care about kids all around you, unstructured time can be a lovely and wonderful thing. If you live in a community where you're facing great dangers or violence and there's no caring adults or resources for you to enjoy as a child, it can be a very scary and intimidating thing. So sadly, there's no one answer.
So which way do you think we're going at this point? Are we heading toward a longer day around the country?
We're definitely heading towards more time. More and more districts are embracing this notion that educating students is a far more complex endeavor in the 21st century than it was in previous times, and that schools may need to just devote more time to the enterprise. There are some places, though, and again, not to ding the state of Maryland, I'm a proud Montgomery County parent, but that has chosen to go in the opposite direction by making their summertime longer than it was in the past. So I think it all depends on the community and on the students and what the parents want. But on the whole, yes, we're moving towards more learning time.
Do you remember how long your school day was?
I have visions of 8 to 3, but I'm fairly sure I was asleep for the first hour, so it probably cut it down a bit.
Yeah, I was in high school, I was 8 to 3:50, but I did have a free period in the middle of the day, so yeah.
Yeah, kids have a lot of free periods now, too. That's the other thing, and they're allowed to go off campus.
That's Maria Ferguson, who is Executive Director of the Center on Education Policy at the George Washington University. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
In Florida, utility crews continue to work around the clock to restore electricity to millions of homes and businesses after Irma. The storm knocked out power to more than half the state. Eric Szilagyi, CEO of Florida Power and Light, the state's largest electric utility, has called the outages unprecedented.
It's also the first storm, by the way, that has impacted all 27,000 square miles and 35 counties that we serve across Florida. It is a magnitude that we just haven't seen before.
The utility says it hopes to have service restored to its customers along the east coast of Florida by the end of the week, but estimates customers on the west coast of the state may not have power back until late next week. Ted Curry is Director of Energy Studies at the University of Florida's Public Utility Research Center. He advises utilities on storm preparation, and he joins us now via Skype from Gainesville. Ted, welcome. And first of all, I should check, did you lose power at your house?
Actually, we were one of the lucky ones. Roughly two-thirds of the customers in Gainesville lost power. We did not lose ours. What we did lose was cable and internet and our cell phone service. So we spent Monday listening to the radio and trying to figure out what was going on outside. And I think it's a shame that it takes an event like this to show people how critical that infrastructure is. It tends to be something that we take for granted.
Yeah.
But at times like this, we don't take it for granted anymore.
Yeah. So tell me, though, I understand that Florida utilities are actually better prepared now for these hurricane events than they were in previous years, specifically, you know, the years before, what, Hurricane Wilma back in 2005? So what's changed?
Actually, it was the entire 2004-2005 hurricane season. Florida was hit by 10 hurricanes over that period. And following the 2005 hurricane season, the Florida Public Service Commission gathered all the utilities and industry stakeholders and customer groups and really any interested party into a series of workshops in Tallahassee to talk about what can Florida do to better prepare. And they talk about the preparations that they've made for the upcoming storm season so that people can learn. And the results have been striking.
So information sharing is always vitally important, and it's terrific to hear there's a lot more of that going on. But I'm also seeing sort of like specific infrastructure and structural changes, right? I mean, Florida Power and Light, they've invested more than $3 billion in protecting their power grids since 2006. You know, even things like replacing wooden power poles with concrete ones.
Sure. Part of that process has been refining the types of things that we do in order to harden against storms. You know, one of the major initiatives that came out of the series of workshops were refining the utilities practices with regard to vegetation management. So making sure that trees and bushes are clear along utility lines and utility transformers. And another initiative was to kind of formalize this benefits of various storm hardening practices. You know, in the wake of storm events like this, it's very common for people to say, well, why don't we put all the lines underground?
Yeah, I was wondering about that, actually.
The thing is that in a lot of cases, putting lines underground may make things worse, because what you're doing is you're shifting the risk of damage when you relocate power lines. When they're above ground, certainly they are more susceptible to damage from wind events and from flying debris. But when you put them underground, they're more susceptible to storm surge and flooding. So it's very important that in Florida, we don't have a blanket policy. You know, all lines should be above ground. All lines should be underground. So it's really a risk trade-off when you decide how are you going to harden the system.
So, I mean, given that, what more could or should the utilities be doing to further harden, as you say, the power grids in Florida? Because it seems like with every passing year, we're just going to see bigger, stronger, and more frequent hurricanes.
I think the first thing to keep in mind is that utilities unilaterally don't do anything. Electric distribution utilities in the United States are all regulated companies. Now, who regulates them is different. You know, here in Florida, we have five investor-owned utilities that are regulated by the State Public Service Commission in Tallahassee. We also have municipal utilities that are owned by cities, and they're regulated by either city boards or city commissions. We have cooperative utilities that are regulated by the customers that they serve. And it's important to understand that the utility by themselves doesn't make these decisions. It's a cooperative effort among the utility, the regulator, and the government, because no one of those entities can address this problem all by themselves. It takes the involvement of everybody, and that's what we've learned.
Well, Ted Curry is Director of Energy Studies at the University of Florida's Public Utility Research Center, speaking to us from Gainesville. Ted, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Magna.
And before we go, this note, Nobel Peace Prize recipient Aung San Suu Kyi is canceling her trip to the UN General Assembly next week. The de facto ruler of Myanmar and one-time icon of democracy is facing widespread criticism for not stopping atrocities against the minority Muslim Rohingya in Myanmar. We'll have the story this afternoon on All Things Considered. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Robin Young is back tomorrow.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.